Channel 141, HUR Voices,
Washington, D.C.,
a part of the Howard University Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about climate change and environmental equity in communities of color. My guests are Damali Harding, Business Development Director for Oracle Utilities, O-Power. She is also on the board of directors for the American Association of Blacks in Energy. Also joining us, Charmaine Brown, co-chair of the Maryland Commission on Climate Change. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can also tweet me at HFisherWHUR, or you're welcome to follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Let me go to Daryl. Daryl calling from Washington, D.C. Daryl, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
How you doing today?
Doing just fine, thanks.
I was calling to add a little bit about the deregulation and how those bills got to be high. And I have a couple of other comments I wanted to make. And my first, let me start with my comment. Our infrastructure in the United States is wrecked. It's terrible. This Texas thing is just the beginning of some terrible things that's going to happen. And we're opening up our borders to more people to come here. We are not prepared for another million people to come to the United States. So we should really think about that when we're talking about immigration laws and what's going on, because I work in construction and I've seen some things that you would probably think if you saw in our infrastructure.
Okay.
And secondly, when this is how deregulation works. You buy your kilowatts for the time that you think you're going to use your electric. So you buy it cheap, you might get it for 3 cents in the morning, you know what I'm saying, when you need it, and it's going to be 50 cents later on, you know what I'm saying, when you don't need it, you know what I'm saying. But they're people at home all the time now, so they're charging them an enormous amount of money because they're using the electric all day long, you know what I'm saying. So when you need to, and you got the whole Texas pulling on the grid at one time, you know what I'm saying. So they're using peak electric, you know what I'm saying, at peak times, and that's why the bills are so high.
Okay. Well, Daryl, thank you so much for your comment. I appreciate your input. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Charmaine, something that you said earlier that took me way back to Hurricane Katrina when you talk about environmental equity. And I think that is illustrative of exactly what you mean. When the flooding started, those who could afford to get out got out. But so many black people died in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina when the flooding, you know, started, the levees broke because they could not get out.
Yeah.
And that, I think that is a prime example of one of the things that you're looking at.
It is absolutely. And when we talk about this issue, that is the first thing that comes to mind. And it pains me to remember Hurricane Katrina. I actually did a tour of the lower Ninth Ward after Katrina. And I still remember, and that's the poorest ward, if you don't know what lower Ninth means. It's the most economically challenged. And the X's on the doors, I still get emotional, and that is where people perish. Hurricane Katrina displaced over 800,000 people. 80% of the people impacted by Hurricane Katrina were black indigenous people of color. And so I love this conversation about deregulation and access. But I think about infrastructure a little differently. There's the actual physical infrastructure, mm-hmm. and then there's the infrastructure within a community where you don't really have the access to information. Putting information out there isn't necessarily access. Are you thinking about the folks who are disabled who aren't able to get that information? Are you thinking about those elderly people who You know, they're not able to read and understand what deregulation means. They just get these big bills and they can't figure out why they're getting those bills. Are you thinking about that single mother who's working 2 and 3 jobs and she got it in the mail, but she just hasn't had a chance to open the mail yet? So we have got to put the kinds of resources and support into our communities to make sure that the poor don't pay more, and not just in terms of the economic cost, but the irrecoverable cost with their lives and their health, because that is happening too.
But let me ask you specifically about that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but and let's talk about Black folks, and we talk about concerns about schools, for example, and why are Black schools having so many difficulties. And, you know, often one, not all, but one of the issues is, well, you talk about, you know, parents aren't participating. They're not going to the school board meetings.
Oh.
Or when you go to city council meetings or zoning board meetings, until it becomes problematic, you don't see a lot of Black people in these meetings. Anecdotally speaking, having covered zoning meetings and school board meetings and city council meetings from the East to the Midwest, as I said, anecdotally speaking, until people start seeing these buildings come up in their communities and they're wondering, well, where did that come from? So is there a piece from the Black community that means that we have to keep our ears to the ground before the zoning board votes, before the school board votes, before the city council votes, before these signs go up, before the buildings go up, before the building of other things that we don't want in our community happens? And we're not taken by surprise.
Well, I think that from my perspective.
And you're active.
My lived experience, Black people aren't there because they're disinterested. I think Damali said earlier when we were talking about, the senior deciding whether or not they're going to get their medication or pay the bill, the energy mm-hmm. bill. Black people are constantly in this society having to navigate and trade off where you shouldn't have to trade off.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a systemic issue. And what sometimes happens when we have these conversations, it's to blame the victim. Well, no, mm-hmm. you should have been at Johnny's class that day. You know, people assume what you were at the nail salon. You hear these ridiculous things. You're trying to feed your family. So I think Black people need more support, period. Economic support, emotional support. I mean, look at COVID. If that didn't illuminate for all of the people who, could say before we didn't know, if that didn't illuminate the disparities in our society, I'm not sure what will.
So how do we, whether it is climate change or and environmental equity in our communities, or whether it has to do with the severity of weather-related infrastructure, do we, Damali, have to wait for a crisis for us to pay attention?
And the answer to that is no. So I'll give an example. When I was in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is the poorest major city in the country, we, along with the utility, so not just the electric utility, the gas, the water utility, with support from the state, would do presentations in the communities, right? So we went to rec centers, we went to churches, we went around the city to help people understand what are the resources available to you. Because I think one of the challenges, and I'm sure Charmaine will agree, is that it is hard to navigate. How do I sign up for a discounted electricity rate, a discounted gas rate, a discounted water rate oh, plus my home now is leaking because it's raining more often than it did before, and I can't afford to get my roof. But there's a program that, you know, the county might have to help me, but I can't figure all of that out because I'm trying to go off and work and just survive mm-hmm. and not catch COVID on the metro. So one of the challenges, you know, that we have, and I think that cities are starting to look at it in a solution-oriented, is this idea of wraparound services, right? It's never just one issue. You know, it's you have to bring energy. You have to bring housing. You have to bring mental health. You have to bring nutrition. You have to bring education. All of those have to come together in a way so that our communities can take advantage of that. And the idea, again, around kind of coming it back to climate change, that becomes more necessary because our communities now need to be built for resiliency. So it needs to be built for this idea of, you know, Sandy's going to come through every 5 years. How are we going to prevent that so that I don't have, you know, my roof doesn't pour water into my house and ruin everything I own every 5 years? Right. And so you have to kind of think of this idea of both wrapping around the service to include the entire person and building and thinking about resiliency of do we change our building codes? Right. So you're starting to see states. New Jersey was a great example after Sandy asking questions of we need to change how we build buildings because this is going to happen again. New Orleans did that same thing.
Charmaine,
that's a really good point on the wraparound services period. I'm sorry, Harold.
No, that's fine. But I want to talk about something more broad because I think we need to make sure that we have an understanding of what the trade-off may be. In our communities. Let's put Hurricane Trina aside and move forward. Mm-hmm. We have seen, let's take Prince George's County, our dear Prince George's mm-hmm. County, where a year and a half or so ago, there was a question about bringing an Amazon warehouse to a residential community. Okay? It didn't happen. But you have, on one hand, you have hundreds, thousands of jobs in a municipality that wants to address economic development. But then you have other people who say, NIMBY, not in my backyard because it's not pretty. Mm-hmm. Okay? That is a prime example of that scale teetering back and forth related to what something like that can do economically and what it may mean environmentally. Trucks, pollution, noise pollution. Okay. We can talk about the casino. A great and the National Harbor, a great economic engine. Okay. But you have more traffic, more people. So how do you, when you talk about the environmental impact,
mm-hmm.
not just climate, not just what's coming down
yeah.
from the sky, but what's coming up, that man-made mess, plastic and pollution and all of that other stuff, how do you balance that?
That is a great question. And it's a complicated question in my mind because it goes right to the heart of it, right? Whether or not you're going to be viably, you know, employed or, you know, whether or not, you know, you've got all the clean air in the world, but somehow you can't eat. I think one of the things you mentioned Prince George's County that Maryland is doing is they've got the greenhouse gas reduction plan, and it's very aggressive, where the plan calls for 50% reduction by 2030 in greenhouse gas emissions. Part of the plan also says that while we're doing that, we've got to create jobs and green jobs. So I think Maryland is trying to balance exactly what you're saying. you know, make sure that we bring down the greenhouse gas emissions, make sure that while, you know, we're bringing on new businesses online and maybe creating more issues in terms of traffic and pollutants, we also have plans where we're planting millions of trees in urban areas. So I think Maryland's plan is to try to balance the impact to the environment while making sure that people can have viable, you know, careers and a quality of life. But I'm not going to tell you that I think that's a simple problem to solve for, because it's not. I mean, it's complicated, but you've got a lot of really smart people who this is their job to try to figure it out. And I can tell you, making sure that when we create new jobs, we're also looking at the impact on the environment is part of that plan.
Damali, you spoke about information, wraparound services, and the like. So what kind of resources are we talking about to address power equity in communities of color? As I said, the Charmaine Browns and the Damali Hardings and the Harold Fishers of the world, that's not who this conversation is for. But this is for those people who are living day to day. Is my electricity on? Okay. Is my bill paid? You know what? You know, what am I going to do about my light bill this month? That's who this conversation is for. And so how do you not only help save them money wherever they happen to live, but also, as you mentioned, protect them?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's a continuation of what Charmaine was talking about, right? So there are ideas of community-based energy sources. So thinking through things like community solar, where the community can buy into a solar grid that can actually power that community. In Philadelphia, for example, they have a program called Solarize Philly, which specifically puts rooftop solar on low and moderate income households, and then the technicians that actually service and do the installation are at-risk youth from Philly that are trained by Philly. And so you now have this in this entire ecosystem of where you are creating green jobs, you're reducing your environmental infrastructure impact, you are reducing your energy cost because now they have solar that they can sell back into the grid, as well as creating jobs. And so when we're thinking about this idea of green cities, smart cities, clean cities, whatever buzzword you want to use, it really takes somebody looking at it from vision and somebody to actually, you know, go to the table. It takes a Damali or Charmaine, a Harold, to sit at the table and say, no, what are we doing about this? Because if you look at National Harbor, for example, going back to that, one of the things that they have is they actually have electric buses that run that now you're replacing diesel. So that, again, reduces the impact to that community. You then can have those buses serviced by people who are trained in the community. And one of the things I want to make is this idea of green jobs. And, you know, somebody asked me, well, what's the impact for the Green New Deal? Is a real thing. So in the state of California alone, there are more people working on solar than there are in coal in the entire country. So just put that into perspective when you multiply that out across the entire country, that solar jobs, you know, installation, looking at electric vehicles, you know, being able to fundamentally code your car to go where you want, are jobs that pay living wages. And you don't have to die of you know, black lung in 30 years because you're not going down and inhaling coal dust. And so the more that we put pressure on, you know, go to your utility, go to your public service commission, ask, we want green. What can we do in our city? Ask your city, can you even get solar installed in your rooftops? Because surprisingly, there's still a lot of pushback in cities for a lot of different reasons. So ask these questions. But again, going back to our communities, the more that we can create this in our community and create, again, self-financing, you know, a lot of solar options don't even require you to pay at this point because the solar installer basically gets the money that you would make. And so making sure that we're educating our communities and going out there. And again, it's a piece by piece, but one of the things that I am seeing more of is that utilities want to be partners now. utilities actually are looking for ways that they can go into the communities and say, how can we help you prevent these problems? And what can we do? And this is a recent development. So five years ago, utilities weren't asking these same questions that they are now.
Charmaine, that's great. I want to let's do the Wayback Machine again.
Okay.
1 year after the earthquake in Haiti, I was there in 2011, and. One of the things that really struck me that had, I believe, nothing whatsoever to do with the natural disaster was the sea of plastic bottles littering the street. I don't mean a few dozen or a few hundred. I mean thousands of them everywhere. From the time we left the airport, as you moved around the city, as you moved into the outlying areas, plastic bottles were everywhere. Empty, dirty plastic bottles. What's happening with my plastic bottles that I take the time to separate every time? Because everybody's buying bottled water. Nobody wants to drink from the tap. So you have stacks of plastic bottles with water, you know, whether it's purified, spring, the fancy stuff, whatever. And you separate it so that the recycling crews can pick it up. Okay, it makes me feel good. But what's happening with it once it disappears from my recycling bin at home? Is it being recycled? What's that about?
Well, so since you're going to go way back, I will tell you that I am not the best person to answer that. I separate mine, and the recycle truck comes and takes it. And I do know now that when I go to the grocery store, of course, I carry my own bag, but you no longer have the option for plastic. So I'm probably not the best person to answer that, but since I just want to be clear, though, to go back to something you said about the three of us. So I know when I was growing up, you had to turn off the light when you were not in a room. Like if my parents came home and every light in the house was on, you'd know about it. So we grew up where if you're not in that room, that light gets turned off. And so if we weren't talking about environmental, you know, equity and climate change or any of that, we were talking about the pocketbook aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And so that is still an issue today. And when you grow up like that, I think you tend to be wired like that. So I'm still turning off all the lights. You know, I'm still, you know, calculating that all the time. But I wish I had a better answer for you on the recycle. But
well, I guess, let me broaden the conversation again. Recycling.
I can answer that, though.
Okay.
Please
do. Because I am severely curious about it. I want my efforts to be a part of the solution to the problem.
And the reason that I actually got into this, again, not to throw him out, but actually it was my husband who made me really look into this more in depth. And the short answer is it really nothing at this point. So I wasn't aware, but most of the recyclables from the U.S. went to China, and they were sorted there, and they were graded there, and they were supposed to be recycled there. But several years ago, just basically due to the amount of the that they got from the world, that stopped. And so there's actually been a movement back to, if you remember when we first started recycling, we had to separate paper, plastic, and aluminum. And that's why you're actually starting to see some municipalities, because to bring that back on shore, we don't have the full capabilities of doing these full sorts. Although it is jurisdictional, it does depend on where you live. Some jurisdictions do have the ability to do that. But one of the things that's very worrisome to me is this idea of microplastics. And so,
what is a microplastic?
So this is now going to alarm you. But microplastics are basically plastics that have broken down so much that scientists are saying anytime it rains, it's raining plastic. And that from that cycle that now, and this is something that they're starting to see and starting to test and starting to look at, what's in the dirt. You know, they're just starting to kind of realize, like, have plastics broken down so far that we can't test them. And so they're just starting to ask these questions, and they're finding plastics in rainwater. They're finding plastics in dirt, in agriculture areas. And so I am now, every time I get a package, I just, it's almost a self-shame cycle because I'm like, look at all this plastic that's unnecessary. But you're starting to see countries, I forget which Scandinavian country now has banned, single-use plastics altogether. And you're starting to see more of that around the world. So, the more that we see that, the more that we can start recycling and start asking those questions. But it is it's a phenomenon that we are, just starting to really understand now.
And I think that kind of information is something that people need to really understand. Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked that question is because there was an article in the Washington Post earlier this week, I believe it was, that said that your plastic is not being recycled the way that you believe that it is.
Yep.
And I am not of the mind that says, well, I put it in a bag and I've separated it. I don't just forget about it once it's gone. I am concerned for, not only for the environment for myself, but also for, my child and my child's children and so forth and on. And so I think that this issue of environmental concern and equity, two different things, because, you want to protect the planet. You want the air to be clean for everybody, but you most certainly don't want to have problems in your community where other communities, Charmaine, don't seem to be having those same problems.
Yep.
I'm still stuck on it's raining plastic. I agree with you, but that is just, startling.
Yeah, it leaves you speechless.
Never heard that before tonight. Yeah, I had not heard the whole microplastic issue.
Mm-hmm. Something to take back to the Maryland Commission on Climate Change.
Absolutely.
To have a discussion about.
I'll send you a link to an article.
Wait, I'm glad you asked that question, Harold. I do want to just quickly, I think we're running out of time.
Yeah, sure, go right ahead, real quick.
We talked about a couple of things, and I want to make sure that our listeners know that Maryland does have assistance for energy efficiency for low-income households and communities. And so, people can go out to the website. And
what is the website?
That information, it's mde.maryland.gov/DDRA. And so I just want folks to be able to go out there, get the information. And there's some other incentives. There's an Empower Maryland program as well that can